to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
And welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Delighted to welcome back someone I feel like has become a good friend, John Kinsella, Irish composer. This is our sixth show with John, and I feel privileged to do it because he's one of the leading living composers, born in 1932 in Dublin. John Kinsella, what's your birthday?
It's the 8th of April, 1932.
So that makes you 85?
85, yeah, and counting.
So you look forward to be 86?
Yes, indeed.
Well,
I just missed being born on the 1st of April by 7 days, which would have made me an April fool.
We're all fools, but that's another matter. I'd like to remind our listeners where we started with your music in our first interview. And so for that reason, before we move on to the cello concerto and the Seventh Symphony, I wanted to play a little bit of your Elegy for Strings, which I think is one of the most beautiful pieces of music in that style that I know of. I think it rivals Samuel Barber's famous Adagio for Strings for beauty. And let's take a listen to the first part of your Elegy for Strings, which I believe was written in 2011. You've been listening to John Kinchler's beautiful 2011 Elegy Strings. John, what occasioned that work?
It began life deal as a movement rather like it in my Ninth Symphony, which was written for string orchestra, and which is largely based on a chorale that Bach uses a lot, Jesu meine Freude, and quite a lot of the symphony, this movement is a kind of central part of the symphony, which is quite a busy work otherwise. And this is a short period of stillness within the work as a whole. And I thought it might stand alone, so I did an orchestral, I sort of arranged it as a piece to stand on its own. It was actually played publicly here in May of last year, or this year, actually. So, yeah.
Well, it certainly does stand alone. I think it's an outstanding piece and will last for a long, long time in people's ear and in their awareness of beautiful music. Now, according to my records, we have talked about your third symphony, your fourth, your fifth, your sixth, and your tenth. And in the second half of the program today, we're going to talk about your seventh. And, of course, I plan, and I hope you want to as well, to talk about all your symphonies eventually on radio show. And tell us, though, it's a great privilege. And we're about to listen to your first concerto that we've played on our program. We're going to listen to the cello concerto. Now, where does this cello concerto come in terms of the chronology? This the Seventh Symphony was written in or performed in 1997. Where does the cello concerto come?
Yes, the Seventh Symphony was written in 1997-98, and it was premiered at the very beginning of 1999. And funnily enough, my Eighth Symphony was played at the very end of the same year. So the cello concerto was composed just after that. I got a call from our Contemporary Music Center to say that a very interesting Mexican cellist, Carlos Prieto, was in Dublin and inquiring about somebody who might write a piece for him. So he had visited Dublin a number of times, and through his ambassador then, Daniel Dulson, he got the idea of asking an Irish composer to write a concerto for him. So that's how the whole thing came about.
And this is the recording we're going to listen to. Now, tell us his name again.
Carlos Prieto.
And are you happy with the recording?
I am, yes, indeed. It was recorded by the Orquesta Sinfónica de Jalapa, I think is the correct pronunciation, Mexican orchestra, which is actually conducted by Carlos' son, Carlos Miguel.
And by the way, to our listeners, the cello concerto, all the music we're playing is commercially available. If you go to Amazon, or I do a lot of buying off of Presto Music in England. I download a lot of. I think it's quite good. They have all your work, John, there, and they're very easy to work with. Another good source is eClassical, which is out of Denmark or Sweden. I think Sweden. And then another good place is Shandos.net.
I'm not conversant with that one. Yes.
Oh yeah, I do a lot. I buy a lot of downloads. So this piece we're about to hear, the cello concerto, could you say it was from the same period as the Seventh and Eighth Symphonies in your work?
I think so. Certainly, the first movement. The work actually is in two movements, and the first movement is very rhapsodical, and the second is a much more affirmative music. It's allegro, and I see the first movement as a search for a theme, and in the second movement, I hope we then deliver successfully the...
The theme
that the Chela has been looking for, yes.
What we're going to do is we're going to listen to the first few minutes of that first movement and then the last few minutes of it. It's too long to play the whole thing, and then we're going to move to the second part. So let's listen to the opening of the cello concerto, the first part. And this is marked what, John?
It's marked, can't remember now what it is.
Is this the appassionato? Is it appassionato?
No, it's the, yes, I've marked it quasi una fantasia in the form of a fantasia.
And let's listen to the very first few minutes of John Kinsella's cello concerto. We've just been listening to the opening minutes of John Kinsella's second cello concerto, which was, I think, performed first in 2000. And I was looking on a list, John, and I see that you wrote an earlier cello concerto in 1967.
That's correct, yes. It was performed in the following year. It was one of my sort of big forays into serial music using full orchestra. Yes.
What do you think of your first concerto at this point?
Well, at this stage, I see it like a sort of huge sprawl of the work, you know, where I was making kind of maximum effort to push the limits of everything I was thinking at the time. And it turned into quite a gigantic piece. But I think my current thinking would be to modify the work quite a lot now.
Well, your description of the fantasia here of the first part of the first section of your cello concerto was very helpful in listening to it. And one of the things that struck me is your use of brass so quickly in sort of dialogue with the cello.
Yes, bringing the cello in with a kind of fanfare idea, following up the discussion with them then through the movement.
And I don't recall a cello concerto that I can think of that makes such a prominent use of brass, at least so quickly.
Well, so quickly, no. Certainly further on in this concerto, Dvorak uses brass with astonishing effect, you know.
Right, right. Well, let's listen to the end, the last few minutes of this first half, this fantasia, this search for a theme of your second cello concerto from the year 2000. Just heard the end of the first movement, Fantasia, of John Kinstler's second cello concerto from the year 2000. John, I think you all but gave away your theme there. We'll find out when we get to the second part. Now, what is the second part? It's marked, if we
it's
find our theme.
Cambrio.
Oh, yeah, this is quite.
Yes, we found our theme now.
This is quite jaunty. It's quite pushing forward. There's no moments here of much rest.
No, just pushing forward all the time, yes.
Okay, let's take a listen to what John Kinsella did with that searching for a theme. Just heard the ending of John Kinsella's second cello concerto and the resolution, the search for the theme. John, how has this piece been received since 2000?
It's been, well, the actual recording has been reviewed a number of times quite well. And when Carlos premiered work here in 2002, it got a very good reception, I must say. He did an excellent performance. And cadenza, which, leads into the second movement, is a device I borrowed from Shostakovich in his first cello concerto, where the slow movement descends into a cadenza, and then the cello takes over the change of atmosphere and launches the finale on its own. Unaccompanied job on that, I must say.
Yeah, and it's beautifully recorded. And to our listeners, it's on a label called Urtext, on the Urtext CD
yes.
label. And it's available anywhere that you can find classical music. John, you've yes. written a number of other concerti. Could you talk about those?
It's not a form I've used very much. I've composed two cello concertos and two violin concertos. That's it. I've always hoped to get the opportunity to write a piano concerto, but I haven't come across somebody I can work with yet, you know?
Right.
So maybe it's something that might happen in the future.
My
other dream is to write a concerto for bassoon.
Really? You were trained in the viola. Have you ever thought about writing a viola concerto?
No, I'm too aware of the difficulties. It's much easier to stand back from an instrument when you can't play it, you know?
Right.
Or even attempt to play it, let's say. So you can see the thing in a much more relaxed form and leave all the horrors to the actual soloist.
Well, I think that your cello concerto is quite successful, and there's a recording available of it on YouTube for any of our listeners that want to hear it. Now, where did that performance come from, the one of your violin concerto?
The second violin concerto, yeah, that was performed
yes.
in Dublin.
So that was a live performance?
Live performance, yeah, 1990. An interesting point about the Carlos Prieto's cello, it was used in the first performance of Haydn's Seven Last Words of Our Redeemer on the Cross in Cadiz. So really? He could actually prove that that cello was in the orchestra, which was actually initially performed as an orchestral piece, and he can trace the history back. And it was also owned by a dealer in Dublin as part of his history. So I think Carlos wanted to tie the whole thing together, because the actual cello had a Dublin history as well. So it kind of brings the whole thing together.
That's wonderful.
It's lovely.
Wonderful, and a wonderful tone. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with John Kinchel. We're going to talk about his seventh symphony, the one that he thinks of being associated with Jan Sibelius. We'll be right back.
The Dominican Doctor of the Church, St. Thomas Aquinas, describes St. Dominic's order of preachers as men living a mixed life who contemplate the mysteries of Jesus Christ, which overflows with an abundance of preaching and teaching for the salvation of souls. This is Father Benedict Kroll from the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. Have you ever considered a vocation to be a Dominican priest or brother? Our next vocation weekend for the Eastern Province Dominicans will be February 16th to the 18th. Contact me at 800-529-1205 or log on to DominicanFriars.org.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift made from our day sponsor. To celebrate the 39th wedding anniversary of Larry and Sharon Yelnick on this Veterans Day. Larry is also a veteran and honors all those who have served our country. Unforgiveness is the great block. Forgiveness brings freedom. Forgive today. If you have a message you want to share, be a day sponsor at 877-288-1077.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
The church tells us children need mothers and fathers, and science is just beginning to reveal how true that is. New brain research in mammals reveals that involved fathers affect an infant's developing brain differently than mothers. For instance, while a mother's attentive presence and affection nourishes the centers of an infant's brain that allow them to bounce back from stress, an attentive and affectionate father's care stimulates the parts of the infant's brain that allow the child to better regulate their tendencies toward aggression. So it turns out moms and dads play critically important but very distinct roles in their children's ability to lead peaceful lives. Once again, the science is clear. The best prescription for well-adjusted kids is both a present and loving mother and father. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
John Kinsella, he's on the phone with us from Dublin, and we're going to talk about his seventh symphony. And I do want our listeners to know that there's a very good chance that his as-yet unperformed 11th symphony is being looked at by, which orchestra would that be in Dublin?
The National Symphony Orchestra.
Wonderful.
It's run by the RTE radio station. You know.
And I already told John I would be there if it happens.
Okay.
Right now, the Seventh Symphony is in one movement, although there are five parts, and you talk about it being associated with Sibelius. Is that because of Sibelius's one-movement symphony, the Seventh?
Yes, I've always regarded, and I know a lot of people do, Sibelius' Seventh as being one of the huge peaks in 20th century music.
I agree.
In one way, it scares the hell out of me, and then the other way, I just love it, you know.
Oh, I love it, too.
Amazing piece.
It is an amazing piece.
And,
it just unfolds. It unfolds like your Seventh Symphony.
Yeah, there's a number of parallels. Sibelius' piece finishes on C. It's in C. It goes from B to C at the very end. And I follow the same procedure, but totally different type of orchestration and setting. But there's the use of the trombone, which is very reminiscent of Sibelius for me. There are big passages for the solo trombone, and that's echoed off stage by another trombone in the distance answering back. So we see if that comes across clearly on the replay of the recording.
Well, our mutual friend Bob Riley said this about your Seventh Symphony. That's what you said, that the work was written with a keen awareness of Sibelius' Seventh Symphony. Yes. But Bob Riley says this is in the way of homage rather than imitation. The same is true of the Bruckner influence evident in Kinsella's ability to build symphonic movements of overpowering mass and uplift. And then he says, the brilliance of his highly imaginative, fantastical orchestration did not lead me to think of Stanford, that is, the Stanford who was the Irish symphonist of a century ago, but of Berlioz. And I think I've said to you before on this program that it does remind me of Berlioz, too. But let's listen into the opening part of the 7th century. There are three sections marked maestoso, mysteriously, and this is the first.
Yes.
Let's listen. Just heard the opening, the maestoso movement, the first of three in the maestoso section of his seventh symphony. And, John, that is an absolutely thrilling opening. It has the word that comes to mind is drama, but it also has moments where the light comes through the clouds a bit.
Yes, I think there's a kind of parallel between this work and, you know, the cello concerto is a search for a theme. And I suppose one could look on this symphony as moving from a slightly chaotic situation towards a peaceful ending. And like in the Sibelius Seventh, I use the same form where he presents a number of themes and then comes back, represents them in a slightly different way, and a third time, and then there's a coda. So it follows the shape of the Sibelius Seven quite closely. Of course, the material is quite different. But so, in a sense, it's a journey towards peace.
I think, it reminds me of the Sibelius Symphony because it has a kind of almost cathedral-like sound. I mean, it's coming, it's tumbling out of the skies, so to speak. And
yes,
as it tumbles, it broadens and it lengthens, it widens, and it's like covering the sky as it comes down. Just a beautiful piece. Let's listen to what you do here in the second section of this one movement work marked Allegro. That was the opening of John Kintzler's second section of his Seventh Symphony, marked Allegro. John, you said somewhere that a symphony for you starts with the feeling that something important is to be said rather than something entertaining. What did you mean by that?
Well, I suppose that's the general view of symphonies nowadays. You know, when they began as entertainment from the orchestral suites, and they've even grown, like with Shostakovich, into big political statements. And people like Mahler and that, and Bruckner constantly declaring his belief in God.
Yes, so that's true.
Big ideas.
I'm going to quote you on that. Well, in your own way, you're doing the same thing, but not quite as blatantly.
Not in the same class.
No. Well. But
I'm doing my thing.
Your heart's in the same place. Let's listen now to the third section, which is also marked Maestoso. It's played mysteriously. Let's listen. Maestoso section, the third section of John Kinsella's Seventh Symphony, and one movement work. John, why did you use three sections marked mysteriously?
I keep going back to rework the same idea, see would it lead in a slightly different direction, because the work is aiming towards a quiet close, like a fulfillment, and to finish, as I say, leading from B to C, and giving a sense of peace insofar as I can express it.
So it's simply a matter of symphonic development from section to section?
Develop, yeah. Moving from Mysterioso into Allegro and see where that Allegro will lead us. And on the third revolution, it actually succeeds in getting where it wants to go.
Well, let's listen to the next section, a marked Allegro of your Seventh Symphony. Just heard the Allegro section of John Kinsella's Seventh Symphony in one movement. Let's move right on to the next section, Maestoso, the third Maestoso of the Seventh Symphony. Let's listen to it now. Thank you. That was the third maestoso movement in John Kinsella's Seventh Symphony.
Yes, yes.
John, that becomes quite reflective. It contrasts with the dramatic, kind of propulsive feeling of the
yes.
opening sections. Is yes. this a symphonist and taking a breath?
It's taking a breath. It's getting where it wants to go, you know, wants to resolve and end in a peaceful fashion. Whereas the opening was very edgy and active, so we're calming down, if you like. It's also, perhaps, you know, the famous trombone solo from Sibelius' Seventh. If you could imagine that floating across outer space, disappearing into the cosmos. Not so much the theme as the sound of the trombone itself, you know.
When I was in graduate school, John, I had a professor in a modern literature course talk about the history of music in relation to some of the literature we were discussing, and he said, he made the comment that whenever you have great horn themes and great brass themes, you have nobility. You agree with that?
Yeah, well, it's certainly, if the audience is certainly react, you know, to really great fanfares.
Well, also you have those kind of mournful trumpet calls in the background, and
yes.
they're quite beautiful. Now, in this, in the last section, which is also marked epilogue, you bring in a chorus at the end.
Yes.
And what brought that
it's
on? What brought that to your mind?
Chorus.
Yeah.
It's just, again, it's the feeling of traveling away from the earth, you know, out into infinite space, if you like. It's an off-stage choir. They don't appear on stage.
Well, what does a wordless chorus sing, John?
They just sing awe. You know, it's the vowel awe. That's all you need to do.
It's extremely effective. Let's listen to the entirety of the last movement, the epilogue of your Seventh Symphony.
Thank you.
That was the end of the epilogue of John Kintzler's Seventh Symphony in one movement. John, that's just powerful. That's just sublime. And I might say that this is a symphony in particular that repays with repeated listening.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm so glad it speaks to you.
Well, it's great talking to you again, and we have a few more symphonies we want to hear in future programs, and we really look forward to the first public performance of your 11th sometime next year. And thanks for being a guest again on Church and Culture.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that very much.
Again, we'll talk to you again soon, John. And to all of you who are listening, we have another wonderful guest after this short break.
High school juniors and seniors, college seniors and graduates, you're invited to the Ave Fall Fest, Thursday, November 16th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Domino's Farms in Ann Arbor. Learn about the incredible Ave Maria University Michigan Scholarship of $28,000 over 4 years and the generous Ave Maria School of Law Michigan Toledo full tuition scholarship. Meet admissions counselors and enjoy dinner and giveaways all for free with registration at AveMariaFoundation.org.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Psalm 23 teaches us about God through the image of a shepherd, as it illustrates what a good shepherd must know and do for his flock. A good shepherd knows how to find food and water and leads his sheep to those locations. A good shepherd knows the landscape. He knows where to find shade and which are the safe paths. A good shepherd is able to protect his sheep from those who want to destroy them. Thus, sheep are tended by a good shepherd and have safety and security, nourishment and rest. In John's Gospel, Jesus proclaims himself to be the good shepherd. Psalm 23 teaches us what Jesus offers to us as our shepherd and what he wants to provide for us in our daily lives. Let us pray that we will let Jesus guide, nourish, and protect us as our shepherd, that we may rest with him in this life and the next. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, CBSMICH.org.
Fire on the Earth, Peter Herbeck. Every one of us is going to appear before the judgment seat of God. Scripture says, in a hurry, life is short. It's a passing shadow. We're here today, we're gone tomorrow. And it's very clear in Scripture, the teaching of the church, we'll all give an account before the Lord. What did we do with the gifts, the graces, the resources that we've been given with the time that we've been given on earth? And friends, this is a time for the body of Christ, for the people of God, to mobilize. Not to run and hide, but to mobilize around the fundamental truth and grace that Jesus has given his church to be light and salt in this world. And right now the Lord's pruning the church a little bit because it's not so bright. The light is not so bright because there's lots of compromise with the world. A lot of people drifting with the culture. And if the church looks compromised in places, if she looks, her salt has gone flat, what does Jesus say? What does he say about that? Throw it out. It's not any good to him. He said, look, I gave you the light. I made you salt. I made you. I seasoned you. And you stopped paying attention to it. And you've lost the edge. You've lost the urgency. You've lost the passion that's in my heart. And I want to give you my passion so I can use you to seek and save the lost. Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is it really possible to discipline your children without getting angry? I'm Dr. Ray. Well, yes. And well, no. What's one of the easiest ways to be calm when you discipline? Act early in the chain. A very typical discipline scene unfolds something like this. Butkus decides to ignore, defy, or debate you. You repeat yourself, prod, argue, threaten. Butkus resists further, talks tougher, escalates.